This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Though they may be the things we remember most, life isn't really made up of big events. Life is made up of an ongoing string of normal, everyday events, many of which go unnoticed or are quickly forgotten. The same is true of history. We remember the big stuff. Pearl Harbor, 9/11, the Kennedy assassination. But how many of you think much today about the Wilbur Mills scandal? Not many, I'd wager. And in its day, that was pretty big stuff. Nope, history is made up of small things, miscellany. And that's what is behind a new website called NC Miscellany. The site is home to hundreds of little-known facts from North Carolina's history and is the product of our two guests this hour. John Blythe is Special Projects and Outreach Coordinator for the North Carolina Collection at the University of North Carolina's Wilson Library. Among his responsibilities there is editorial supervision of the North Carolina Miscellany blog, to which he is also a contributor, and he joins us today from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Nice to be here.
And Lou Powell is with us in our studio, a retired Charlotte Observer columnist. He is a frequent, really frequent contributor, because I was looking through it the other day. You're everywhere on this blog, to the NC Miscellany blog, the web address for which can be found by going to our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. Welcome back, Lou.
Thank you, Mike.
Good to see you. Where did the idea for collecting little-known historical tidbits and then assembling them on this website? I'm not sure whether to call it a website or a blog or both or what. Where did the idea come from, and what should we call it?
Well, you can call it whatever you like, but I think most properly we probably would refer to it as a blog. And its origins date back to 2005. Two of my colleagues who worked in the reference desk at our collection, the North Carolina collection, were uncovering all kinds of interesting stories as they helped patrons research their own questions. And they realized that there's a lot of things that they were sharing with each other that, as interesting finds that they thought we should share with a wider audience. So that's the origins.
And you referred to the location that John Blythe works as the Sanctorum a few minutes ago, Lou Powell. So how did you, because you're down here in little old Charlotte, how did you become involved in this?
Well, the view from little old Charlotte is different from the view from Chapel Hill. But I moved to Charlotte in 74, which happened to be the first decade in which more people moved into North Carolina than moved out. And that made me an immigrant. And sometimes immigrants see things that natives don't see. And I was struck early on by the cultural conflict of North Carolina. For example, Charlotte versus the rest of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Charlotte is kind of like Hong Kong as opposed to China. And the great state of Mecklenburg, of course, is the term that is often used to describe that. But the state as a whole has such diversity. There's a professor at Stanford who has recently come out with a study saying that East-West countries have more cultural diversity than North-South countries. But he will not extend that to states just yet. But you look at North Carolina, and it is very horizontal as opposed to Alabama, Mississippi.
I think he's right. I think it ought to be the states of East and West Carolina, not North and South.
Yeah. But to me, in addition to the usual mountains, Piedmont, Sandhills, coastal plain diversity, there's the contrast between the North Carolina being part of the old Confederacy and being part of the Eastern Seaboard, which makes for a lot of stormy weather, politically, culturally.
So how did you become involved in this? Just because of this particular perspective that you have?
Yeah, it was a gradual thing, and thanks to the North Carolina Collection at Chapel Hill, there's a great resource for studying, looking into that kind of thing and getting help.
This website.
Well, Mike, one other thing that Lou hadn't said is that Lou is a great collector of all kinds of things, including political ephemera and particularly political buttons. And so back in about 2007, Lou very generously gave his button collection to us at the North Carolina Collection. And we asked Lou, you know, pick out a few buttons, start writing about them. And that was one way we established a sort of lured Lou in, I guess, and got him to help us with the blog.
I think some of these buttons or photographs of these buttons are on this blog, I think, because I saw them over the weekend.
Indeed.
And they go way back, these buttons. What's the oldest one?
Probably 1898.
They had buttons back then.
Yes, that was just when it was starting. Celluloid had been recently invented, and somebody, after they discovered that billiard balls would explode and catch on fire when made out of celluloid, they looked for other uses.
Yeah. So your button could catch on fire and explode.
The McKinley-Bryan presidential race was the first one to have pinback buttons. But the first one that I remember in North Carolina just said white supremacy. On it.
The website, the blog, is called NC Miscellany. What's the difference between miscellany and trivia?
I think I would say it's more marginalia than trivia. You could say that it's the sprinkle on the ice cream, but I think it's a little more substantial than that. Sometimes a small story leads the way to a big story.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking the other day at Ted Turner's autobiography. He owned the station in Charlotte for a time, which he called WRET after his initials.
It's what is now 36, Channel 36, WCNC.
Correct. And he was struggling with that station, and what saved him was he traded the rerun rights for Marcus Welby and Ironside to WSOC for Andy Griffith, which enabled him to keep the station going and to sell it and to use the proceeds from that to start CNN.
Huh.
Can I jump in for
a
second? Another reason for calling it North Carolina Miscellany is actually, here's a little history lesson. It harkens back to some titles of other publications about North Carolina in the 60s. A North Carolina State English professor named Richard Walser published a book called North Carolina Miscellany, which had a lot of the same kinds of things that we feature on the blog. And there have been newspaper columns dating back to the 1800s where it was miscellany or North Carolina Miscellany. So we're even trying to play off the state's history just with the title.
Yeah, that column you refer to was in an Edenton newspaper in 1832 and 1833, devoted to general news, politics, literature, religion, commerce, and agriculture. So have you taken some of these earlier publications and the information contained in them and augmented your collection with them, or is this an offshoot of that in your mind?
Oh, offshoot, I'm not sure. I guess so. I mean, one of the things that we have in our collection is, in some cases hard copies, and in other cases microfilm of North Carolina newspapers dating back to really the first North Carolina newspapers, which is in the 1700s. And North Carolina was rich with newspapers. We occasionally, on our blog, feature bits from old newspapers, and we have some other projects at the library. One is a organization called the North Carolina Digital History Center, and we're digitizing North Carolina newspapers, and I think you can access it from our blog, but we have links and blog posts there, even a Twitter feed with an interesting headline each day from an old North Carolina newspaper.
You know, as I said at the very beginning, and I think I'm right about this, correct me if I'm wrong, that life is just a string of miscellaneous things. I mean, this program is a piece of North Carolina history for the moment, and will be in a second or two after I say these words. It's gone, and it's part of the history. So how do you decide what is worthwhile and what is just an event that happened and, okay, let's move on? How do you decide?
Arbitrary. Everybody has his own eye for what's interesting. I like conflict. If I were a real historian, my specialty would be conflict, particularly cultural conflict rather than wars and crime. But I like to see two factors bumping against each other.
John, what's your take on that?
Well, I would agree. I'm always up for a little conflict. But I think I also, I'm fascinated by people and both sort of the well-known, interesting, unknown facts about the well-known folks, as well as sort of the lesser-known folks.
But I mean, as all this stuff comes, I don't know whether it comes in a trickle or whether it comes in a waterfall over the transom into your area of expertise. How do you decide, well, this is something we need to include, this is something we need to investigate, spend time on, have Lou write a piece on, or have somebody else write a piece on for the blog? How do you decide?
I wish I could say that the editorial process is this well-thought-out process. I guess I'm like we're pulling the curtain back from, you know, the Wizard of Oz. But it's really, we have about five contributors, Lou and several other staffers at the North Carolina Collection, and we come across interesting tidbits, and we think, there's a little bit that we can tell. There's, you know, maybe an interesting excerpt from a book, or I hear about something and, you know, an event in the headlines and think, I start to look for ways that you know, stories, similar stories from the past, and just sort of mine our rich collection.
Are you attracted only by clashes of culture? Is that what attracts you to want to write about something?
Sometimes I try to stretch myself a little bit more to things that aren't just clashes, but the range of things that is possible is just endless. North Carolina is such a source of events, people, unlikely happenings.
Could that be said of every state in the country, or is there something special about this state?
I'm sure other states could make their cases. Mm-hmm. However, North Carolina is so well historified, if there's such a word. But thanks to the North Carolina Collection, thanks to William S. Powell, who has almost single-handedly recorded history like no other state has had its history recorded.
No relation, unfortunately.
Because
you're supposed to be retired. It would seem to me that researching miscellany, finding it, deciding this might be worth investigating, maybe going down a couple of dead ends and deciding not to write about it, or investigating further and deciding to write about it and then writing about it. That sounds like a lot of work for a guy who's supposed to be retired.
Yeah. I don't garden or play golf.
He digs into North Carolina dirt, I guess.
That's right. So does this take a lot of time? As you compare this to your life in newspapers, does this take as much work as that did?
Not as much work as that.
Of course, you can work on your own time. You know, you're not on deadlines.
Yeah, my wife would say it takes a little too much time.
Lou Powell is our guest, retired Observer columnist who contributes to North Carolina Miscellany. John Blythe is special projects and outreach coordinator for the North Carolina Collection at UNC's Wilson Library, which is responsible for this. We're going to come back and we're going to find out more about precisely some of the things that you will find on this blog or this website in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeastern University Charlotte, hosting a graduate roundtable on August 8th for degrees in specialties like finance, leadership, and taxation. Details at northeastern.edu/Charlotte. You know, there are things that we all say. We're talking about miscellany trivia today, but there are things that we all say, but we never think about in terms of how they originated. So tomorrow, a show that is a horse of a different color with a topic that's a bit off the beaten path. I mean, we don't want to beat a dead horse or be accused of having an axe to grind. So on to a topic that's brand spanking new. We're going to explore the history behind some of the most well-known phrases in the English language. A bit more miscellany. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next I and Ream show, Officials in London hope the Olympics will be an economic boon for the city, but prior hosts have found that's not always the case. The economics of hosting the Olympics.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about North Carolina miscellany, not just the fact that it exists, but also the fact that there is a blog about it that is run in part by the North Carolina Collection at UNC's Wilson Library. That's where John Blythe joins us. He's Special Projects and Outreach Coordinator there, and Lou Powell is one of the contributing writers to this blog. He's a retired columnist for The Observer. A News and Observer, a Raleigh News and Observer article about you, Lou, mentioned that you are driven to uncover obscure and relevant North Carolina culture lore. Obscure, I understand. Relevance, I'm not sure about. Talk to me about that.
Mike, you're a tough sell.
No. I don't mean that to be an insulting question. I just mean, what do you mean by relevant? I mean, how do you determine what's relevant if it's obscure?
just for the record, the NNO picked up that story from the Charlotte Observer.
Okay, well, okay.
That's a good Observer man there.
Well, they didn't quote the Observer. They just quote, never mind. What's the answer to the question?
Yeah. Remind me what the question was.
I have no idea.
how to determine relevance.
How do you determine relevance, yes.
small influencing large, I think, would cover it. For example, Stephen Colbert's two brothers and father died in the Eastern Airlines crash in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. He has said that led him to try to cheer up his mother by entertaining her, which created the comedic personality that we see on TV now.
Hmm. And because that happened in North Carolina, that becomes, even though he's from South Carolina, that becomes a part of our miscellany.
Yeah. Well, that was the Charlotte crash.
Right.
The crash
right.
was in Charlotte. But things that may seem small at the time, and then turn out not to be so small.
Because some of these entries that are on this blog are not terribly long, a couple of paragraphs, maybe even one paragraph in many cases, just to expand on the fact that something occurred. Here's why. Here's a little background. Mm-hmm. So how do you determine when you're done with a story like this? How do you know when that's enough, I don't need to write any more? That pretty much elucidates it.
I like concise so that people don't glaze over when they see a lot of words. Mm-hmm. On the page. But also thanks to the device of links, you can put something of a few words up there and have a couple of links for people who want more.
Want more, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this, John, I'm told, is updated every single day. Is that right?
Most every day. Thanks largely to Lou, who gives us copious blog posts. But, yeah, we try to keep it updated, put new material on there. That's what keeps people coming back.
Yeah, I was talking off the air to Lou a minute ago, and we were talking about how he seems to be one of the most frequent contributors to this, although there are other contributors. If you go online and look, a lot of these were written by you, John, but many of them by Lou. So how do you find enough material every single day?
I mean, I have that same question.
I mean, is there a cat? You have a backload, a card file that you just okay? We're doing this one today, and this one we'll save for tomorrow. I mean, how do you do it?
The internet is a big place. Before the internet, you had books, microfilm, which were pretty slow going and not always very rewarding. Mm-hmm. But with the internet, you can type in North Carolina and all kinds of things come up.
So you spend your entire day on the computer, don't you? I'm getting this impression that you're just sitting there trolling the internet for tidbits. Is that what you do? Seriously?
Next question.
I'm going to call Danny and find out. Because you have contributed more than 740 posts since June of 2009. And are you actively searching for more? Or seriously, do you have a backlog of things that you know about that you simply haven't gotten to yet?
I have a backlog, and sometimes they are provoked by something I see For example, there was a story the other day in the New York Times about a rumor that the radical Islamists were going to tear down the pyramids. Turns out not to have been true, but that reminded me that about 30 years ago, I tracked down a report that the Bull Durham Bull had once been painted on the pyramids. Mark Twain wrote that, and other people had written it also.
Is that true?
Not true.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it would have been a somewhat better story if it were true, but it was kind of interesting finding out that it was not true. Apparently, it was an exaggeration that became rooted in semi-fact.
How do you see this little project, John, as in terms of what you do at the Wilson Library and what and the function of the Wilson Library? How do you see this project?
Well, it's in my job title is outreach, and this is one of the primary tools for outreach, and we're reaching not only throughout North Carolina but throughout the United States. And if some of the analytics that we use are to be trusted, then we reach other countries as well. I think some of those may be the spammers that we're constantly dealing with, but we do reach reach out to the country.
Have you found as this when did this begin? What year did this project begin?
2005.
Okay, so have you found that over the years, as people discover this and find it? Because there are a lot of people who would be interested in this. If you're interested in this kind of stuff, you're probably interested in, you probably know things yourself. And you probably want to get that information out as well. So are people contributing unsolicited to this as a result of having found you?
Yes. Well, both people occasionally send us ideas and say, oh, you know, did you see this in this particular magazine? Recently, there's some steady readers who've told us about several pieces in a magazine called Garden and Gun when North Carolina gets mentioned. But we also have people, I mean, the great thing about blogs, about social media is it can be a two-way conversation. So we have commenters, and there are some regular commenters who correct us if we're wrong, who expand the story, all of those things.
You were going to jump in there. I saw you.
I was going to say one of my favorite responses was to a post that we had on the Love Valley Rock Festival in 1970, where the Allman Brothers showed up. A guy who had photographed the Rock Festival back in 1970 for UPI sent a response and said, here's a link to the pictures that I took. These are wonderful pictures that would have been virtually non-existent if he had not sent this link to them. It was a terrific contribution.
Wow. You have a lot of different categories. It's not just famous people in this blog or even famous institutions in this blog. There were a lot of, when I was on it, there were a lot of recipes on this blog.
That's a recent feature,
okay.
And that's thanks to one of our staffers, Allison Murray. The North Carolina collection, among the many things we collect are North Carolina cookbooks, and she's fascinated by, well, she loves cooking, and don't we all love eating? So she's been going through the cookbooks and just finding interesting recipes and then putting them together with interesting sort of themes. When Andy Griffith died, she went to the numerous cookbooks that have some tie to Andy Griffith and found recipes, So we're constantly putting up recipes now, which is great.
Yeah, and you're not just typing them in. You're actually taking photographs in some cases of the original recipe cards that people had in their card file?
They're from the books themselves. We take a photo, an image of part of the page. And what's great about that is sometimes there's these little, funny lines, or you see someone's name, the name of the person who contributed the recipe.
Mm-hmm. Navy grog was among the recipes for drinks that I discovered.
Have you tried it?
No, I was going to ask you, have you?
No. Not sure I would.
What are some of the other categories of things that have found their way onto this blog?
Oh, my goodness. One category we have, and I can't say which. It's sort of a chicken and egg question. I'm not sure which came first, but we have On This Day. And the man sitting in the studio with you has actually put out a book called On This Day in North Carolina History. So he's quite good at finding those kinds of things.
Well, Lou, it's Monday, July 30th. On the day of this original broadcast, Monday, July 30th, do you know what happened on this day off the top of your head?
I have no idea.
Nothing like putting you on the spot. So if you wrote that post, he wrote it months ago, right?
Yes. Yes.
Is it difficult to find? I mean, you know, when you pin something, it's one thing to write about an event. It's another thing to try to find an event that happened every single day of the year down through North Carolina history. How difficult is that to do?
It's mostly done. So that a lot of these are recycled from the book that I did in 95 or whatever.
But I find other ones. How difficult was it?
It was laborious.
Yeah.
And that was before Google.
Yes, that was before Google. It's a lot easier to find things with Google now.
You seem to have this penchant for wanting to do this, so obviously it's a labor of love for you. Love doing
it. It's a curious itch of curiosity.
And you talked a little bit earlier about North Carolina being other states perhaps being able to have this interesting history, but you think that we're even more interesting.
Yeah.
And you say that North Carolina is unique because we have our own quirky culture and history. What do you mean by quirky?
I think it's connected to the conflict. When you look at, for example, the fact that we had as U.S. senators simultaneously Jesse Helms and Terry Sanford, mm-hmm. Shows a psychological rift of some depth. And these other states, let these other states call in. If they think they're quirkier, let's hear from them.
Yeah, let's hear from South Carolina.
Yeah.
We occasionally like to tweak South Carolina on the blog, try to stir things up. And you know, the Charlotte area, I was talking earlier about analytics. I mean, when we do, you charlatans are...
charlatans.
Yes, exactly. Well, charlatans as well, but... you're very provincial because anytime we do a Charlotte related post, boy, our readership spikes. But we have also plenty of readers in South Carolina, Fort Mill, mm-hmm. Columbia, Greenville. So
you're saying that we're touchy about what you write about us down here. Is that what you're saying?
Well, actually, that's interesting too, because recently, as you may have noticed, Lou has done several posts recently, I guess in preparation for the Democratic Convention, where he's put up various insults that folks have, well, mostly insults, terms that folks have used to describe Charlotte. And, again, our traffic has shot way up. Not too many people have taken issue with them, but,
What are some of the insults? I think I had them here someplace. What are some of the here we go. You wrote this blog a couple of weeks ago titled about George Washington not being the last to knock Charlotte. He, of course, called this a trifling place when he came through. So what other vile, nasty, untrue statements have been made about us?
I'm not sure what was in that post, but one of my personal favorites, because I was reporting it, was when Robert A.M. Stern, the mm-hmm. architect who was doing a series for PBS at the time, visited Charlotte maybe for a fundraiser.
This was in the 80s, wasn't it?
Yes.
I remember this. I remember this being a very insulting, touchy thing. It was all over the papers and the broadcast. Go ahead.
Yeah. We walked around downtown Charlotte, mm-hmm. and He was not impressed. He, unless you would say that calling Charlotte the ugliest collection of third-rate buildings in the country qualifies as being impressed. He was quite full of himself, and I was there.
But now this
with
is
my pad writing it down as fast as I could.
But I'm not sure he was wrong, and I think it spurred a lot of new buildings that we have today that we didn't have then that completely changed the look and the character of the city. Don't you think?
I would agree.
I don't think we'd have the IMPA Bank of America Tower had it not been for this guy coming through and saying, look at all these glass and white concrete buildings you got here. It's crap, is essentially what he said.
Mm-hmm. It could be. It could be that that was just a kind of tipping point moment in Charlottesville.
I mean, I'm looking at some of – I'm looking at Lou did a post yesterday with additional comments on Charlotte, and here's one that Bette Midler apparently uttered at a 1994 performance at Blockbuster Pavilion. It was either us or a monster truck show, and Lou also uncovered one where Chris Rock had sort of a similar thing. You know, there's nothing going on in Charlotte. And here's a great one from Peter Applebaum, who at one time was with the New York Times, I think may still be. I happen to love Charlotte, which may edge out Dallas and Atlanta as home to the purest strain ever discovered of the Southern booster gene. Ooh. And I would say that there are folks in other parts of North Carolina who might feel the same.
Yeah. Chris Rock said, so much to do, I don't know how y'all made it here tonight, when he opened up his show at Ovens in 2003. And then, Mike, speaking of tall buildings, Mike McIntyre, author of The Kindness of Strangers, Penniless Across America, had this impression of Charlotte in 1996. The tall buildings, crowded sidewalks, and endless stoplights confuse and annoy me. A damp doom descends on me. I feel like my luck just ran out and washed down the gutter. Who is this guy?
If we haven't stirred up people in Charlotte by now, then I don't know. Then it's a sleepy town.
Now, do you, in your collection of miscellany about North Carolina, are you as rough? Do you have comments that are as rough on Raleigh or Durham or Chapel Hill or Greensboro?
Oh, no, no.
And of course not.
Not at all.
Of course not.
Says this proud Chapel Hillian. Of course not.
Are you serious?
I've not seen them.
Lou, get
your
work.
I'm sure there are. Sure. Actually, I'm sure there are plenty of, I think of various comments folks have made about Chapel Hill, you know, supposedly, and we're still looking for the real source of this. You know, supposedly Jesse Helms said put a fence around, when there was discussion of the state zoo, where to locate the state zoo, Jesse Helms said put a fence around Chapel Hill. Well, I don't think he actually said that, but it sure does make a good story.
He probably wished he had said it.
Lou,
exactly.
You need to get to work on this descriptives of Raleigh and other cities, so that we can have a level playing field here.
Charlotte is such a tempting target, though. Big is always a tempting thing to strike out at.
Well, Kerry Collins, who was quarterback for the Panthers for about 10 minutes here back in 2007. He was here in his rookie year, said, I dreamed about playing in the National Football League all my life, the Eagles, the Giants, the Redskins, the Bears. But I found myself playing for the Carolina Panthers, wearing this funny-looking uniform, and I didn't even feel like I was in the NFL. Okay, well, we'll take a break because we have to recover from that now. And we'll come back and talk about more North Carolina miscellany. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Isiola Lodge at Linville Golf Club, featuring local fresh cuisine, a Donald Ross Championship golf course, fly fishing, and spa, located off the Blue Ridge Parkway. Information, isiola.com. Officials in London hope the Olympics will be an economic boon for the city, but prior hosts have found that's not always the case. Diane Rehm and her guests discuss the economics of hosting the Olympics coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE or online, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Hi, I'm Christopher Kimball, host of America's Test Kitchen, heard Sundays at 3 p.m. on 90.7 WFAE. Our program is filled with clear, practical information and techniques that illuminate the truth about real home cooking. There'll be some mystery, too, like why bad things happen to good recipes and the science behind good results. Join us this Sunday at 3 p.m. for America's Test Kitchen on listener-supported radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Lou Powell and John Blythe about North Carolina Miscellany. John Blythe is Special Projects and Outreach Coordinator for the North Carolina Collection at UNC's Wilson Library. He joins us from WUNC in Chapel Hill. Lou Powell's in our studio, retired observer columnist and frequent contributor to this North Carolina Miscellany blog that you can also find the address of on our website at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Maybe you have some questions or comments of your own. I just gave the phone number out a second ago, 704-926-WFAE or 800. I don't remember the number. I say it automatically, 800-603-WFAE.
This has got to be a historic moment.
Yes, make a note of that and put it in your blog.
That's going to be on the blog. Exactly.
Or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. A Facebook comment has come in. As a tour guide working primarily in D.C. and a casual history buff, I am so proud to tell tourists that Mecklenburg Scots-Irish sent a notice of independence from Great Britain a year before the rest of the colony. Now, this has been a matter of particular debate here in Mecklenburg County for years and years and years, and we don't seem to be coming any closer to the veracity of it. What's your take on this, Lou? Because you're from Mecklenburg, and John, you obviously don't like us here because you're up there in Chapel Hill, and you've already given us that impression.
I have to confess, my roots are in Mecklenburg County.
Okay.
And more than that, my roots are in Huntersville, near Alexandriana, where John McNitt Alexander lived. And in fact, my middle name is Alexander. I'm related to John McNitt Alexander. So I want to believe, and I do believe in the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, despite the many of my colleagues who don't. I want to believe.
Some people want to believe. Some people don't want to believe.
Where do you stand on this? Are you willing as a journalist to tell us?
I yield to the professionals. Uh-huh. I haven't ruled it out, but I'm still waiting for a fragment of the actual paper to show up.
All right.
And it hadn't yet.
Comment from our website. This is great. Are these guys North Carolina's Walter Edgar? I'm not sure who Walter Edgar is. John, do you know who Walter Edgar is?
I'm sorry.
Because Luke, we don't know. Okay, because we don't know who he is. So if you want to write us back and tell us who Walter Edgar is and enlighten us here, that would be appreciated. One of the articles, Jim, that you are responsible for on this blog that I read at least, has to do with an historical perspective of campaigning in North Carolina. And since we're in a campaign or an election year here, it might be interesting to talk about this because you reprint a long paragraph. Yeah. From Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper, November 29th, 1884, describing voting in the mountains of the state. How did this come to your attention?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because we're actually holding there's a long answer, which I think I'll give you. We're holding a conference on historic political campaigns in North Carolina in mid-September, and we hope some of your listeners might attend. But while sort of looking for images and stories that might help augment and help publicize that conference, I came across this illustration from Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper of folks at a polling place in Swain County. We have, we're a rich collection. We have these kinds of things, and I just happened to come across it, and there was a interesting little story, the excerpt which we put on the blog about how folks in days of old, they would walk around with what would you call them, pitchers, I guess, at a polling site, and you would drop, in whichever the pitcher of the candidate you liked, you would drop in your vote. And I think there was plenty of brandy and other nice libations there to help you make your decision.
Let me read this post. It's not that long. The polling places of such out-of-the-way districts as Nantahala Precinct, Swain County, North Carolina, where our sketch was made on the day of the late presidential election, are not provided with all the modern conveniences, nor are the honest voters addicted to vain pomp and personal display. The sacred privilege of the franchise is exercised in an old wagon shed adjoining a corn crib. The judges, he is a small man indeed in that section of the country, who bears a less important title than that of judge or colonel, seated on the bench are the inspectors of election. Each guards a tin coffee pot, which serves for a ballot box. Occasionally, a judge leaves his seat and circulates amongst the crowd, electioneering, coffee pot in hand. Refreshments in the form of ginger cakes and cider are to be had on the premises, and such a thing as a drop of blockade whiskey is not, we presume, wholly unobtainable. The gathering is a mixed one and includes a paroled convict in uniform who probably is employed in the construction of a railroad in the vicinity. There is not much style about the battling up there in the mountains, but in the great national result, the votes count just the same as though they had been cast in a crystal and nickel-plated ballot box in a brownstone front polling place in the city. It gives one pause when you look at the illustration and read that paragraph to realize how we have elected our people down through the ages. How would it have been done in 1884 in Raleigh or Charlotte? Much different from this? Do we know?
I don't know, but I imagine it would have been fairly similar.
And when they talk about electioneering, is he going through the crowd in either encouraging people to vote or campaigning for a particular candidate?
I think the term electioneering there is campaigning. I think electioneering has gotten perhaps, we tend to use the term electioneering now, I think, as a pejorative term, but I think there it's just another term for campaigning.
So he would take the judge of the election, the guy who's charged to make sure it's fair, would essentially carry the ballot box around and encourage you to vote for a particular candidate?
That's what I think. You know, it's interesting also, if I could just, it reminds me of another blog post that one of my colleagues did several years ago. We have in our collection some ballots from the 1868 North Carolina election, and the ballots are all different colors. And what that actually, the significance of that is that back in those days, your voting was not private. Everyone could see it. And so, you had a red for one candidate, blue for another, maybe white for another. And it put a little pressure on you when you knew that everyone was watching to see which color ballot you were going to drop
Was that also color? Was it color coded also because some people were illiterate and couldn't read, and they knew that the red ballot was for the candidate of their choice, and the white ballot wasn't?
Well, that may have been as well, but you were on the hook. Everyone knew who you were voting for.
And I'm curious about this other thing. The election judge, the man who's supposed to make sure it's fair. And if you look at the illustration that's provided by Frank Leslie's Illustrated newspaper, it's just a bunch of people sitting around with drinks standing around with drinks. And if you're walking in this crowd, how do you know that the people you're campaigning, you're electioneering with, haven't already voted, and you're telling them to vote again? How do you know?
Does that matter?
Okay.
I wonder how those people would think about TV commercials of today, whether they would think that was an improvement or not.
Who knows? But there are a lot of things like this illustration. The paragraph would stand on its own. The illustration would almost stand on its own. But taken together, it really gives you a real feel for what was going on back there in 1884. And that's true of a lot of things on this blog. It's the niceness of somebody like Lou Powell writing about it, and then there is the actual item that you can actually look at. It's almost like being in a museum. Is that the goal?
Yeah, I think John could describe this better than me, but I think it's the miscellany is a digital extension of the collection.
We've gotten some information here about, according to a Google search, who Walter Edgar is. He was, or is, I think he is, a famous South Carolina historian and professor from USC, University of South Carolina. He had a radio show on South Carolina Educational Television on the radio network. Actually, I've heard it. Huh. He does a historical moment every single day on South Carolina as public radio down there, and I've heard it. So that's who he is. He's
well, how provincial of us not to know him.
That's right.
But you know,
exactly.
He doesn't go south. We don't go south of that border there.
That's a different country down there.
Exactly.
According to one of our tweets, Tiffany and Company mined a Mitchell County mine for emeralds, and you can tour that mine this week at NC Gem Fest in Spruce Pine. Do you know about this?
No, I don't.
I don't either. I know that there's a lot of different, you know, the hiddenite, emerald, all those different minerals. There have been some interesting finds up that way.
It sounds like you have a possible post in your future here with that, Lou. You've also written, Lou, about how little attention Charlotte has received for what happened here during the Civil War. Why are we unappreciated? What are we missing?
I think Charlotte is mostly responsible for that itself, because we always are looking forward rather than back. Mm-hmm. When the Civil War was over, it was over here, unlike, say, in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of neo-Confederate pride about the Civil War in Charlotte.
But the city was important to the Confederacy.
It was, and there's a new book out about Charlotte during the Civil War.
Why is that not more known in the history books? Because until I moved here, I didn't know that Charlotte played any role in the Civil War whatsoever. But we know that we had the Confederate Naval Yard here, which I found to be extremely odd, given the fact that we're landlocked, nowhere near the ocean. But it's because of the railroad. We were able to build things for the Navy, armaments, etc., out of harm's way, and then railroad them to the coast, correct?
Yes. I guess the lack of bloodshed has a lot to do with our being ignored.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there is this lore that the very last, the final, penultimate cabinet meeting of the Confederacy took place here. And there are plaques downtown to tell you this, but other cities have claimed that the final meeting of the Confederate cabinet took place in their cities. Who's right?
I think there are separate distinctions made. The last full meeting of the Confederate cabinet, as opposed to partial meeting of the Confederate cabinet and other distinctions. You're right, there are like half a dozen different places that want to claim that.
But the last time the entire cabinet got together was here, before everybody started to disperse to the winds and mostly to Florida, at least Jefferson Davis went to Florida. And he had other meetings along the way, but this is the last time everybody got together here.
Yes.
Was that before or after Lincoln's assassination? We don't know. I don't want to put you on the spot.
I'm fuzzy on that.
Okay. And the gold, the Confederate gold from the Confederate treasury, did that pass through town? Does it linger here, I guess, is the question. Is it here someplace?
I think it's under your studio.
Well, we'll start digging now.
Maybe we all look at the square.
That's right. We'll start digging. Some of the things that you have dug up or uncovered have to do with language. And Lou, you ran across two phrases that were very popular in the 1970s, thanks to a TV show that many people have forgotten, called Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. Now, this was for people who were not alive then, this was a groundbreaking show on television and incredibly funny. And I don't know that there's anything on television today to compare to it, except maybe The Daily Show, because it was political in its own way, in a very vaudevillian way. But there are two phrases that came out of that, many phrases came out of that, but the two that you uncovered were, "Here come the judge," which I never understood, by the way. "Here come the judge," and "Look that up in your Funkin' Wagnalls," because they have North Carolina connections. Explain that.
The guy who came up with those expressions was born in Durham, and his name was Pigmeat Markham. Pigmeat was probably not his Christian name, but I can't remember.
It was his show business name,
yeah,
wasn't it?
I can't remember what his real name was.
You going to tell me more?
I'm not sure how much more there
is. Was he on the show?
He appeared occasionally on the show, but mm-hmm. he was, I think Flip Wilson may have taken those
Flip
lines.
Yeah, he did.
And Sammy Davis Jr., because Sammy Davis Jr. used to walk through the thing and go, here come the judge.
Yes.
Here come the judge. Order in the courtroom. Here come the judge. I don't know why, but that struck people as funny.
It was a different time.
It was a different time.
Pigmeat's first name was Dewey.
Dewey, yes.
Pigmeat Markham.
And then there is the story of the origination of a North Carolina institution south of the border, and which has kind of declined because of the interstates. But back before the interstates, everybody going south through North Carolina into South Carolina and points beyond had to pass by and probably stopped in at south of the border. It's this enormous place that sells trinkets and food and gasoline and stuff. And you see signs for it for miles out, 100 miles to south of the border, 85 miles to south of the border. Pedro says, stop in here, you know. Yes. How did this start?
I think it was about being able to sell beer to get down to the essence of it. I've always thought north of the border would be a good
place. Yes, it's in North Carolina.
Eskimos, Mounties, hockey rink.
All right, you can find out more about all these stories that we've been talking about and a heck of a lot more on this blog, North Carolina Miscellany, and you can get the link to that on WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Lou Powell is in our studio, retired observer, columnist, frequent contributor, and John Blythe, special projects and outreach coordinator for the North Carolina Collection at UNC's Wilson Library. Good luck with it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks.